If you don't know, my name is Ted Goshalak, and I'm an elder here at New Life. And I remember the first time we came to New Life. It was a whole group of us from a church in Vancouver, and we were asked to consider this as a church as we all moved to a housing co-op in Burnaby. And the first person I saw, and even more heard, was Hank. He was only 12 at the time, but, That's why you can be married 50 years, right? But it's been a long journey with Hank. It's been a wonderful time to be here at New Life all these years. We did escape for four to Regina for our cross-cultural experience. So this summer, we're doing a series on New Testament apostles. And the title of it is Learning to Follow Jesus. Now last week, I'll just keep talking. Last week, Sandeep spoke on the life of Matthew. You know him, that tax collector who was called to follow Jesus. And this morning, I want to look at, and we want to consider together, the life and legacy of Peter, Simon Peter. I'd like to start with a few quotes. Perhaps no figure from the earliest years of what became Christianity is more approachable and endearing than Peter. There is something about Peter that resonates in the soul of most Christians, whether ancient or modern. We who are attempting to follow in the footsteps of Jesus sense that in Peter, we have a fellow traveler. That's from Larry Hellyer. And the second quote. If you read through the Gospels, paying close attention to Simon Peter, you will notice how important a figure he is for each of the Gospel writers. In nearly every episode of Jesus' life and ministry, Peter is somewhere nearby. Now, this morning we're going to consider the three passages which Yvonne read. These are all from the Gospel of John, and as we know, there's four Gospels, so this is just one little part of that. But they highlight the person and journey of Peter as a follower of Jesus Christ. So first of all, we're going to look at Peter's call, which is in chapter 1, verses 35 through 42. Secondly, we're going to look at what I call Peter's misunderstanding and misguided promises. Not that we've done any of those, but we'll blame Peter. John 13. And finally, Peter's commissioning in chapter 21. But first, I'd like to consider what's in a name. Now, all these names up here are names that Peter has been called by. This Simon Peter. Shimon, that's Hebrew. Petros, Greek. Cephas or Cephas. Simon Bar Johan or Bar John means Simon, son of John. Peter. And finally, Simon Peter, which is a Hebrew-Greek hybrid. So we have to be careful when we read the New Testament that we got the right Simon. Because actually, in the New Testament, there are nine different people by this name. Two of Jesus' disciples are called Simon, one of them being Simon Peter. One of Jesus' siblings is called Simon. And one of the 12 tribes of Israel was also named Simon, or Simeon. But Peter's given name was Simon or Simeon, and that was a common name at this period of history. His name can be translated as hearing or obedient. Now, you know that we have people who name their children after famous people. There's a lot of Dianas running around from a certain era. There's other people. Peter may well have been named after Simon Maccabee, who in the second century before Christ led a revolt against those who were oppressing the Jews and was very successful. And so he was held up as a figure. And so why wouldn't you name your little boy Simon? As well, you noticed in this list, almost the last third from the bottom is a family name. And this was common. I'm Ted. My father's name was Harry. So I would be Ted Harrison. Ted's Harris. And that's often done in a lot of Scandinavian and probably other countries. And this was done here as well. Now, Simon Peter is one of those names that's Greek and it's Aramaic, both combined together. And this was very good for him because it equipped him for missionary work as an apostle in the Greco-Roman world. It's almost like two sides of a coin. He could turn this way and he's Greek. He could turn this way and he'd be Hebrew or Semitic. And who was this Simon? Excuse me, the one Simon that we're going to talk about this morning. Well, he was a fisherman. His hometown was Bethsaida on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And sometimes, I'm a guy that likes maps. So this is where we're talking about, right up here. And if you go all the way down, Jerusalem is way down there. So this is a whole other part of the Middle East, of Israel. And up there, the people were a little different than the ones in Jerusalem. They tended to be a little less religious and a little bit more mixed into other cultures. Now the town Bethsaida itself means house of fishermen. Simon Peter owned a boat. Now perhaps together with his brother. And by the fact that he owned a boat probably means his father was dead, because the boat would have been passed from father to son. But they worked together with another family who had a father, Zebedee, and two boys, James and John. And the way they often fished was two boats together with a net in between, and they dragged the fish in. But it wasn't just a happy kind of time to be a fisherman, because the Romans were in town. And they didn't really operate a free economy, free market economy. You caught some fish, we'll take a percent. We charge you rental. Fishing licenses. Oh, and by the way, you put your boat up on this little harbor, there's another tax. And the person who Sandeep spoke about last week probably collected those taxes. So James and John and Peter and Andrew probably did not have a happy, warm feeling towards Matthew and the other tax collectors. Now, in 1986, a fishing boat that was dated from the first century AD was discovered on the northwest shore, the Sea of Galilee. Now, it was estimated to be 27 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, 4 feet deep. And interestingly, it was constructed of 10 different types of wood. It's a very complex piece of work. Now, this boat could carry a crew of five. So if you had two brothers, they probably hired people during the day. Day laborers would help them fish. But if you weren't fishing, you could take up to 15 people, which worked well for 12 disciples. And it also had a rear seat. And you remember in Mark 4, Jesus fell asleep in that rear seat. Now, there is a museum in Israel called the Jesus Boat Museum. The chances that Jesus actually sat in this boat, well, not necessarily likely. But it is fascinating when you find things that are from that far long ago that help us make real history. Now, as I mentioned, Peter and his family and their contacts were all fishermen. And fish was a very important part of the Roman Empire. It was this food staple for it. Now, if you were wealthy, you would eat fresh fish. Cook it on a little charcoal fire. That's great. Most of us would be stuck with salted, pickled, or dried fish, which don't quite sound as much fun or quite as tasty. And this is one of the 18 species of fish that live in the Sea of Galilee. Somebody nicknamed it St. Peter's fish. I'm sure he would have liked that. It's a species of tilapia. Some of the other fish were carp, probably not quite as tasty. And so they had to sort the fish. They'd sell the fish by type. Now, another thing about Simon was that he was married. In fact, I think, as far as we know, mentioned in the New Testament, he's the only one of the disciples who was. His mother-in-law lived not in Bethsaida, where he came from, but across the way in a town called Capernaum. And it seems at some point that Simon moved to Capernaum because of the influence of his mother-in-law. Now, as early as the mid-300s AD, pilgrims started visiting Capernaum. And they identified some ruins, which they said was the house of Peter, which he would have shared. The way they would build a house is, here's mother-in-law and father-in-law, kids start adding bits on, and next thing you have like a big area of families sharing space. Pilgrims can be a little bit fickle, but in the 1980s, they actually started digging. Did I have the next slide, Brian? This is a Byzantine octagonal church. In the middle of that church, they dug down. And they found a first century house, which seems to have been later altered into a house church. So once again, doesn't prove everything, but it's just nice to know. And so, of course, they call it Peter's house. Now, if I could have the next slide. For some unknown, ungodly reason, the Franciscans built a monastery right on the edge. It looks like a UFO has landed. They get a good view of the archaeology, but it kind of takes... So if you were there, and I've never been there, I would take my pictures sort of from the side. I don't really want that in my pictures. Now, that's often called Peter's house. You can go visit that as well. Now, Peter had a second house. If we can have that one, Brian. Bit bigger. This is in the city of Rome in Italy, St. Peter's Basilica. And in 2022, Jenny and I were there. Jenny had the wisdom to book an early tour of the Vatican, and we went through, and we had an incredible tour guide. Went through the Sistine Chapel, saw, after a while, it's just art everywhere. And then she said, there's a long wait to get into St. Peter's. They just reopened it. This is just after the pandemic. But I have a door. She opened a door, and we walked into this. Oh, I got the wrong pointer. You can see this is about the height of a person. So you walk into something that's football field after football field large and all gold. I wonder what Peter would have thought. And this supposedly is in here where he's buried. That's a case, or that's for another sermon, but not this one. So, Now, as I mentioned earlier, Peter's presence can be found in nearly every episode of Jesus' life and ministry. As you read through the New Testament, the Gospels, Peter. In fact, he's the most named person in the New Testament, even more than Paul. After Jesus' resurrection and ascension, the first half of the Acts of the Apostles contains 8 of Peter's speeches. And each one plays a pivotal role in the early growth of the new Christian community. But after that, no more Peter. He's gone. The last time he's mentioned is at the Jerusalem Council. So what did Peter do after that? Well, he did write 2 epistles. And we learned from that he traveled. And interestingly, he traveled with his wife to what is now known as Turkey. And if you read the introductions to each of those epistles, you'll say greetings to, and it lists a bunch of places. And so we don't know how many years he spent, but he traveled and just was undercover, so to speak, starting new churches, encouraging Christians. He was not the big figure in Jerusalem anymore. In fact, he had to leave Jerusalem or he would have been killed. But at some point, Peter settled in Rome and appears to have taken on the role of bishop or overseer of the Christian community. But then things changed. In 64 AD, a substantial portion of the city of Rome was destroyed by fire. In fact, 14 districts in the city, only 4 survived. From the very beginning, there were rumors. We know who started that fire: Nero, the Roman emperor. He wanted some more land to build another palace, so he just burnt it to the ground and started building. Well, as the rumors grew, Nero knew he had to point the blame somewhere else. So he focused attention on this tiny community of Christians. And it helped that one of those 4 districts where the fire did not come was where the Christians lived. Aha, there's something suspicious about that. And they pray to the strange god and they drink blood and they eat bread, and you know, they're just different. So the fingers were pointed at the Christians and they were slaughtered. Horrible. And it appears that that is when Peter was martyred. Somewhere around 64, 65 AD. So from 30 AD, when Jesus started his ministry, Peter was on the scene for about 30 years. Now, Peter was called the first bishop of Rome. I think I'm going to show the slide. Who was the second bishop of Rome? Linus. Oops, wrong Linus. This is the real guy. Interestingly, in 2 Timothy 4, which Sandeep preached on a few Sundays ago, he's mentioned. He's one of Paul's companions. And quickly, let's just show those other pictures. I love art. I wandered through the Sistine Chapel and other places. This is what people think Peter looked like. In each one of these pictures, he's holding the keys because he has the keys of the kingdom. Now, the last one, Brian. This is the one I like the most. I think this is Peter. Because it's actually from the first century. It's a graffiti drawing on a wall where Christians met. In fact, graffiti started in Pompeii. So that's when I think of Peter, that's what I think of. So now let's go on to actually look at our passage, our 3 passages. Peter's call. Now, Peter's encounter with Jesus necessitated no initiative on Peter's part. He heard about Jesus from his brother Andrew, who then brought him to Jesus. Now, in the exchange that happened, Peter did not say a word. He was only spoken to. Now, Jesus began their conversation, or at least their one-way conversation, by revealing what he knew about Peter supernaturally. Peter, son of John, I know who you are. And then he gave Peter a nickname, Petros or Cephas, the rock. Now, in our world, we have other rocks. Say no more. Now, Jesus saw past the unsteady, easily unnerved man that Peter appeared to be. Instead, he saw the immovable, foundational, steady, and strong man that Peter could become. Jesus saw potential as well as passion, and that one day that rock would live up to his name. Based on this meeting with Jesus, Peter left his fishing industry and became a disciple. Now, the second passage in John 13, Peter, for certain, almost harbored nationalistic hopes for the Jesus movement. He believed in Jesus' message, but he hoped it was something bigger. He hoped that Jesus would become the Messiah in a military and in a political sense. That he would get rid of the Romans and that he would reign as king. Now, Peter probably hadn't been listening too well because that's not what Jesus was saying. Now, in this passage, Jesus begins the section by making his disciples aware he's leaving. His time with them is at an end. And then in verses 36 to 38, there's a dialogue between Peter and Simon. Peter and Jesus. Peter still, after 3 years, does not understand Jesus' destiny. His focus is on the anticipated absence. However, Jesus reassures him, "You can't follow me now, but you will follow afterward." Now, Jesus tried to point Peter in the right direction to underscore his future role as the shepherd of the sheep and consequently urged him to lay down his life for them, but not yet. Peter must be first transformed before he can offer himself to others. And then Peter pushes it a bit and insists, "I'll follow you to the end. I'll even lay down my life for you." As we know, Peter overestimated his commitment. Jesus' response to Peter's vow doesn't really address his failure to understand, but rather his inability to carry it out. Jesus goes on to let Peter know that not only are his claims in vain, but also that Peter will deny him 3 times that very night. And finally, Peter's commissioning, chapter 21. By this point, Peter had seen the empty tomb. He had been visited by Jesus. And then seven of the disciples, we're going back to Galilee. That's where Jesus told us to go. And we're going to go fishing. So they went fishing all night. No luck. Nothing was caught. At this point, Jesus arrived on the shore and asked them to throw their nets on the other side. And this is the second miraculous catch of fish in the Gospels. Now, suddenly, one of the disciples, not Jesus, recognized, or not Peter, recognized Jesus. So Peter, being who he is and was, leapt out of the boat, making sure he had his clothes on, and headed for shore. Now on the shore, Jesus had already made breakfast, and he shared that meal with them. And then he turned his attention to Peter. And Jesus calls Peter Simon, son of John. Now, this is only the second time he uses that phrase for Peter. The first time is when they first met in chapter 1, verse 42. And I asked the question, was Jesus resetting the relationship? Was he bringing it back to square one and starting new? Jesus then used Peter's recent experiences, particularly his triple denial, to guide Peter along the last steps of his journey. Do you love me more than these? And when he said these, he was probably pointing to the other disciples. For some reason, growing up, I always thought Peter was taken by Jesus to the side. He was saying this in front of all of them, which probably made it a little bit more awkward for Peter. Do you love me more than these? Now, raising this question of Peter's love for Jesus enabled Peter to think seriously about his relationship to Jesus. If Peter loves Jesus, as he says he does, then he'll do what Jesus has done in taking care of the flock. Jesus asked Peter three times, "Do you love me?" Now, that the question was asked three times isn't incidental. It's intentional. Now, Jesus is gently but painfully reminding Peter of his three denials. Each time Peter reaffirms his love for Jesus, Jesus counters by commissioning Peter. Now, the imagery of the shepherd and the sheep points towards Peter's primary role as the pastor of the emerging church. It's no accident that in Peter's first epistle, 1 Peter, he employs the same metaphor to remind the elders of the house churches in Asia Minor of their primary responsibility. Tend the flock of God. This is your charge. He'd got the message. But there's another aspect to being a shepherd. In John 10, it says, "The good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep." Now, having given the final command to Peter to tend his flock, Jesus reveals to Peter most vividly how he will play a part in the final drama, how he will live out his life in submission to God's plan rather than to his own. Failure, as well as encountering his own weakness, humbled Peter. And Peter was willing to learn from this painful understanding. One of the greatest things Peter learned was humility and the grace and love of God. So in summary, the Christian life according to Peter is cruciform in nature. It's the cross. It's all through his writings. For Peter, Christian hope is robust, and it's a robust certainty rooted in the prophetic promises and confirmed by the Lord Jesus Christ. It molds and anchors you from the seductions and storms of life. And another quote. The difficulty with Peter's theology of the cross is not in comprehending it. It's pretty straightforward. But rather the danger of domesticating and diluting it. Although Peter struggled at times, in the end, he lived up to the meaning of his new name. Rather than letting his failures cripple him spiritually and emotionally, Peter used it as a means of building up the flock of God. Peter became a living illustration of forgiveness and the second chance. He possessed a degree of compassion and understanding to wavering believers. Peter's story reveals that we do not need to be defined by our failures. Jesus' message of forgiveness and new life was spread through flawed disciples Jesus' continuous call invites us to return, to receive forgiveness, and to seek restoration. Jesus is the Lord of the second chance. If the disciple who denied knowing Jesus became the rock on which the church was built, there's hope for us too. Simon Peter was not afraid to talk about his shortcomings, and in doing so, to help others learn, grow, and to live in the grace and power that was only possible through Jesus Christ. Peter was a flawed, yet ultimately faithful disciple. I grew up in Chilliwack. Some of you know where that is down the road? I have a family of four boys. Myself, the oldest, and my brother, the youngest, we were the academics. Number three was musical. Number two was athletic. And I always remember the day when he was in grade 10 and I was in grade 12, and he ran in the Fraser Valley finals of the 400 meters. I skipped school because my parents, in those days, parents didn't come to stuff. So I skipped school and I went to watch him. He was in one of the inside lanes. Starter's gun went off, he was off. Around the first corner, he was first. Around the second corner, he was ahead. Around the third corner, still ahead. By the fourth quarter, he finished last. He'd gone out too fast. But he finished. And I think that's what we need to learn for ourselves and from Peter, is that each of our races is different. We do make it, we're flawed, but in the end, what we want to do is to make the finish line. And to say, like Peter said, or like Paul said, I run the race, I finish the course, I receive the prize. And that's what I pray for you and I pray for myself, is that we are those who are finishers. We just don't start well, but we end well. Now, often there's an application question at the end, or application questions. Sandeep had some really great ones last week, but there's just too many of them. So I just chose one, okay? So think about this. If Jesus were to give you a nickname, describing the potential he saw in you, not the person you are, but the person you could become or would like to become, what name would you hope he would choose for you? Rock's already taken. But that's something to think about. And to be aware that we as God's children live in a legacy of people like Matthew and Peter. People who stuck it out till the end. And it always amazes me with Peter. He's probably the person who influenced Mark the most in writing his gospel. He could have told Mark a different story. You know, I was really good, and I knew from the beginning really what was going on. No, he told him the truth as a lesson on how you can fail and yet get up and not count that as who you are. He was honest, and that really has been a legacy to us. So let's pray.